when you said 4 years gestating, I think possibly 4 years decaying, but we shall see. Okay. Telling stories about nature with mathematics. This is the title of my talk. Let's see if... Okay. So in this talk, I'm going to introduce the idea of mathematical models in biology. I'm going to illustrate this with some examples not of work I've actually done, but I think some interesting subjects which might be slightly surprising to you. And then I will talk about some subjects connected with my own research. So this is a talk about mathematical modeling in biology. And first of all, I have a problem, you see, because it's very hard to know what the audience knows. And I'm reminded of a little story by the physicist George Gamow. And somebody was explaining something to him, and they said, but what shall I assume you know? And his answer was very clever. He said, you should assume zero knowledge and infinite ability. And so that's what I'm going to do about this audience today. I'm going to assume you have zero knowledge and infinite ability. And I'm sorry if you have finite knowledge. I'm not sorry that you have finite knowledge. If you have finite knowledge, you might be a little bit bored. But this is where I'm coming from. So what is a mathematical model? What is this thing I'm talking about? Answer, it's a piece of mathematics that describes a phenomenon, something in the world. So we have an image of mathematics. And this is an image of mathematics. Precise writing on a board, a blackboard, in chalk, by a hand, often a male hand. And that's very different to the image of biology. And the image of biology is of creatures like this, beautiful creatures doing interesting things. These are lynxes and hares in a struggle for life. And so the images of biology and mathematics, they're very different. And the question is, how can these go together, or how can we put them together? That's the question. And let's come back to the lynxes and hares. In fact, their numbers have been estimated. And they've been estimated in a slightly unusual context. They've been estimated from trading records of the Hudson's Bay Company. Now, here's a picture of the company, and it looks like the Wild West. It's really Wild Canada. About 100 or so years ago. And I think it must have been a very good company because they kept good records. And they recorded the number of sales of pelts, of hares and lynxes. And so from that, that was a useful source of data about numbers of these creatures around. And in fact, the numbers of hares and lynxes show a remarkable pattern. I've got a pointer somewhere. It's in my pocket, I think. Yep. I've got the most powerful pointer there is. I borrowed this from Francis Ratniak. It's very bright. And so you've got these very remarkable oscillations of both the numbers of hares and the number of lynxes. And when people saw these plots, they were encouraged to write down equations. And the equations are really the mathematical model. And the equations, they try to describe what's going on. And so the equations contain processes. When you do things with equations, you have to build certain things in. And so you have the lynxes, and they're doing something straightforward. They eat hares and reproduce. And they also die of old age, of starvation, whatever. Trapping, of course, as well. And the hares, well, they do something very simple. They reproduce, presumably because they're eating vegetation. But they also get eaten by lynxes. And already at this point, the title of my talk was Telling Stories. Already there's a little story here. Why don't the hares die of old age of starvation? And the reason is, they do, but the people when they were making this model, they thought that the process of getting eaten by lynxes was much more important, much more significant. And so they put that in and they omitted something. And that's what models do, they omit something. And with a bit of luck and a bit of skill, what you omit is unimportant. And this, you can write down the simplest equations with those various processes, and you get remarkable oscillations of the hares and the lynxes. And if you look at the actual data again, it doesn't look a million miles different. This is a little bit noisier, but you have a rather nice apparent agreement between theory and experiment, or theory and data. And the model looks, as I say, like an explanation, but actually is more to the story. In fact, solar activity may be significant. This is a plot, and there are strong relationships or correlations between the number of lynxes and the sunspot activity. Sunspots peak every 11 years, and we see the lynx numbers peak every 11 years. So we don't believe that the lynxes are benefiting from their vitamin D dose from sitting in the sun or anything like that. What we believe is that the sunspots affect the vegetation affects the hairs then affect the lynxes. And so you upgrade the model, you modify it a little bit. And so you include the fact that, of course, the hairs do eat vegetation, but then we can say that the vegetation is periodically influenced by solar activity, the sunspots. Every 11 years they peak, vegetation is going to be slightly different. And so you can learn a modeling philosophy from this. And the modeling philosophy you can learn, well, it goes back to one of the greats, it's Einstein. He said, make everything as simple as possible. But he actually said slightly more than that. He said, but not simpler. And so you mustn't miss out, the key things. So we have Einstein, and we have models, and we can look at another example, the second example. And there's an example that is of interest to all of us, I think. It's the human population number over time. And people have looked at numbers up from time zero, AD zero, up to 2000, and they come up with this curve, and this is the population number in billions. And it shows this very steep rise. There's a typical model of growth, exponential growth. This red curve here, I tried to fit it just when I was writing this talk to the data, and no matter what you do, you cannot make these two curves agree. So the exponential is in red, and the blue is the actual world population numbers. And in fact, exponential is already a remarkable thing. And let me just give you a tiny example. Supposing I take a piece of paper and I fold it in two. And let just suspend disbelief and say I can fold it in half as many times as I want. So you take a piece of paper and say every second I fold it in half, its number doubles. It goes from one to two. I fold it in half again, it goes from two to four. I fold it in half again, it goes from four to eight. So let's say I keep on doing this every second. Every simple question, and that is in fact an example of exponential growth. How many seconds, if I could do it, before that paper would equal my height? And there's the non-intuitive answer of 15 seconds, roughly speaking. So in 15 seconds, in 15 doublings of a sheet of paper, you get to my height. In 30, I think you can get further than America. In under a minute, you can get to the sun. Now, of course, that's exponential growth. We're seeing something, in fact, more rapid than exponential growth. And I know there's some theoretical physicists in the audience, and they will realize that if it takes a minute to get to the sun, you're somehow exceeding the speed of light. But I'll let them explain that to you later on. So we've got some sort of growth of the population which is substantially worse than this very severe thing, exponential growth. And so people studied this. They looked at a model of human population, but they included this nebulous phrase, coalitions, groups of people. And there's another phrase of Einstein, don't look at what people say, look what they do. And so what did they do? Well, they wrote down a model, and the essence of the model is, in a large population, an individual will have a larger number of children on average than in a small population. Just that, something very innocent. So, large population, large number of children per individual, small population, a smaller number. And so this model incorporates only one additional parameter to exponential growth, and that's good. It's not enormously more complicated. And there's when I talk about parameters, I mean things which determine the shape of curves, numbers. And there's a beautiful story of the mathematician von Neumann, and he said, if you give me four parameters, I can fit the shape of an elephant, and if you give me five parameters, I can make its trunk wiggle. And so we have, in fact, three parameters in this theory. So we're not quite up to an elephant or anything like that. And if you can see, with three parameters, with this curve, you get an extraordinary fit between world population number and this simple model with coalitions. And that's rather interesting. And in fact, this model, I'm basing it, there's a paper, quite an old paper, in Science. This is where I got this from. So we have this. We have this great description. It's covering 2,000 years. I can imagine a lot of different subjects would like to have a description that works that well, that covers that amount of period. I can imagine economists would like that, and so on. And we can, once we've got the model, once we've identified it, we can actually write down things like the number of individuals in various years. We can predict them. And this is great. And there's one very interesting aspect of this remarkable law that, in fact, has worked for 2,000 years. And the remarkable thing about this law is it breaks down. It doesn't work. So maybe it is like economics. The model predicts that at a finite time in the future, the human population size becomes infinitely large. So there's going to be infinitely many people. So first thing is, when? When does this happen? When does this event happen? And it happens not so long away, 2026. I think it's close to my retirement age, so if we're allowed to retire then anyway. And so so in 2026, which is just 1% above 2000, so it's just here, population just keeps on going up and up and up to infinity. So the law breaks. The title of the paper says it all. It says, of course, it doomsday, and remarkably they got Friday the 13th. So you may have time for your Christmas shopping, but it's an unlucky day for the human population. We get squashed to death on that date. Okay. I must admit, the cynic in me thinks, what would happen if they calculated Thursday the 12th of November? Would they have got such a good paper out? I'm not so sure. So we have this. We have this model. It breaks down. And there's a lesson that can be learned, and it's a really important lesson. And that's it. That is, once you've gone to the trouble of writing down a mathematical model, its inner logic may take us somewhere surprising, somewhere that you wouldn't guess from just a purely verbal statement of the model. And we can understand a lot, in fact, from the failure of this model, again, which occurs in 2026. We can understand that something new will have to be included in the model. Human population, stupid as all we will are, I don't think we will carry on doing things and squash ourselves to death. So the human population size, more generally, cannot continue in the way it's done for 2,000 years. That's a conclusion we can draw from that. And in fact, a further conclusion is we will see the difference in growth behavior before this doomsday in 2026. And so this is all of conclusions arising from a simple mathematical model. We can, in fact, make predictions about the future of the human race. I consider that really quite good value from a rather small model. So mathematical modeling is good, I think, is a conclusion I'll draw from that. Let's carry on. We haven't finished with this model. Let's look a little bit more at the model. Let's focus in on a tiny time interval around here. Okay, let's expand that view. What we see is the population in billions, and it's growing, and here's the time interval we're looking at, and it's a fairly smooth curve. And if you made this time interval smaller, much smaller, you'd still get a smooth curve. And that's the second aspect of a story that these authors use continuous mathematics to describe what's going on. And that's fine if you're talking about millions or billions. But in some cases, it doesn't always work. And in fact, in a real population, you might see something like this. The population goes along at a fixed number, and then a birth occurs, the population number jumps by one, then it carries on, then there's a birth, and so on. Carries on, a little gap, and then there's a death, it drops by one. And so you've got births occurring, you've got deaths occurring. And this is what you'd see in a real population, if you can, of course, give a sufficiently precise definition of when a birth occurs and when a death occurs. You could have some sort of convention. And so you could say, why do the births or deaths occur when they do? And of course, we sort of know why births occur, and we sort of know why deaths occur sometimes. But really, it gets very, very complicated. And what can we do in this situation? What we can do is we can model things, births and deaths, as occurring randomly. Now, I hear a voice in my head, and it sounds remarkably like my son's, and he's saying, once you say everything's random, you've given up, basically. You've chucked everything out, you see. That's a sort of skeptical thing he'd say. And he's not right, of course. Sons are never right. Okay, so we model them as the births and deaths as occurring randomly. And one way to model randomness, or to deal with randomness, is simulation. And simulation is really the art of imitating a process that occurs in nature using random numbers on the computer. And simulation is, as I say, it's one way to deal with this. There are other ways. Sometimes you have a problem and it's quite hard and you can't actually solve the equations, then you will resort to simulation. So simulation, although it's very informative, is a sort of, it's an easy way of doing things as well. But sometimes it's the only way. So simulations use random numbers. And random numbers are more complex than we think. Just take a coin as that example. You toss a coin, and let's say we score plus one for a head, minus one for a tail. We get two possible answers, plus one and minus one, obviously. This is one type of random number. And this sort of random number is, in fact, something very close to this is what we do to decide if a population increases or decreases by one, whether a birth or a death occurs. Plus one for a birth, minus one for a death. So where is the model? The model is actually in the nature of the coin. The coin is really a biased coin. It doesn't have a 50-50 chance of coming up heads or tails. There's a certain bias. And so the bias that's embedded in the coin, or the bias we embed in the coin, that's where the model really lies. And I'm not going to go into any details about that, but of course you can imagine that there's some complication and some thought that goes into deciding the bias. Also, if we toss a coin, we can have many tosses of a coin before I get a head. And so the result is one toss, or two, or three, or four, or 20. And that's another type of random number. So just with the one coin, we've got different sorts of random numbers. These sorts of random numbers, again with a biased coin, with bias under control, these are the sorts of random numbers we use on the computer to actually determine the time of an event. And so this is not just close, this is extremely close to what we really do when we carry out a simulation. And so here's a time interval between an event, a birth or a death. And as I say, this is equivalent to tossing a coin until a head turns up, but it's a bias coin. Similarly, if we get to an event, do we go up, increase the population by one, do we get a head, or do we get a tail? And that, again, comes from tossing a bias coin. And we control the bias in a principled way. So we're putting in some real modeling into this random framework. Go back to that coalition model, the model with doomsday. Well, just for the sake of this talk, I actually simulated it. And I found a curve that's indistinguishable from the continuous solution that the authors found. Why is it indistinguishable, or virtually indistinguishable? Because the numbers are too large. When you get big numbers, the fluctuations, the randomness doesn't really show up. So where does randomness show up? It shows up in unpredictable situations, such as when the numbers are very small. And one example that everybody who works in population genetics and evolution deals with is mutations. And already we're sort of getting a picture. We know what mutations are. They're random copying errors in genes. Now, I'm not going to explain what a gene is. For our purposes, a gene is something which is simply passed on from parent to child, and it influences something like the color of your eyes. It determines whether you have brown eyes or blue eyes. That's all I'm going to say about genes. These are things which are copied in the parent and put into a child, and they influence the child. And if there are copying errors occur, you have mutations. A mutation sounds very simple, but a lot of things can happen that can require modeling. So let me give an example. Here's a very simple model. We've got individuals, and each individual just carries one gene, something extremely simple. And we start with everybody in this population, or everybody in this group, having the same gene. Let's call it O. We have to wait a random amount of time until a mutation occurs in the gene. And that's exactly like waiting for a birth or a death, except mutations of a specific gene are quite rare. And of course, it depends on the population size and the mutation properties of the mutation. But it could take 1,000 years for a mutation to occur. It could take 100 years, or it could occur immediately. Let's say we've waited. We've actually got to the point where a mutation has occurred. We look in the generation the mutation occurs, and we start off with n adults. I'm doing the modeler thing. N stands for a whole number. It could be 100, 1,000. It's the population size. We start off with n adults. They produce children, and one of these children carries a mutation. And you might not be able to spot it, but there's an X here where everybody else is an O. And you can imagine in a real experiment, people look for mutations amongst thousands of offspring, And again, you have to search for something quite subtle amongst a large group. So say one child carries a mutation. It carries a different gene from the parent. And we're making this model. The adults die. The children remain. The children mature, but we only allow N to survive to be adults for the next generation. And that's really a part of ecology. You could say there's only a limited amount of space or limited resources. You can support N adults initially. By the time they grow up, you can, again, only support N adults. So the situation is, what this mutation, possibly, it got into the next generation. Much more likely, it didn't get into the next generation. So it'd be lost. So it would appear and be gone. And even if it did get into the next generation, again, here's a mutant individual. It has its mutant children. They are amongst all the children of the population. And again, there's just chance that maybe one or two mutants got into the next generation, and maybe they didn't. The typical situation is they do not get into the next generation. Even if they change or improve a population, an individual, they modify them in some way till they're better than their neighbours or the other individuals, still unlikely. And in fact, here's a simulation again. We start with a single mutation, a single individual that's got a mutation, and you see what happens as time goes on. What happens is the numbers go up and down in some random way. The typical situation is after a short time, they're gone. Then they're not selected amongst those N individuals to contribute to the next generation. And in fact, what we know from theory is if you have a population size of 100, and if you have the simplest situation, this occurrence, this loss of the mutation, occurs something like 99 times out of 100. So this is the typical situation. You lose the mutation. Once in 100, on average, a mutation starts off. You get one copy of a mutation, it moves around, and after a while, everybody in the population carries that mutation. Everybody is, if you like, a descendant of this one mutant individual. So we have this situation. And one of the problems I've been interested in is in mutation of many genes. And many genes come into play when we talk about things called quantitative traits. What's a quantitative trait? Something like your height, although it can be more complicated, it's a feature that's affected by many genes. And people, of course, these are biologically and economically important. If you look at maize or corn, the amount of oil it produces, that's a quantitative trait. If you look at cows, how much milk they yield, that's a quantitative trait. And if you look in fruit flies, well, this is a well-studied organism that people have a lot of quantitative traits, and they've measured all of them. So this is quantitative traits. And the trait value of an individual, something like their height, depends on the chance of surviving. And there are many examples where there's a best trait value. What do I mean by that? I mean, if we look at a bird, a typical bird that migrates, like a reed warbler, this is something I've taken from the literature, it's got a measured survival. People ring them. These migrate from, I think, Sweden to Africa. And if their mean wing length is 66 millimeters, typically they live 350 days. If their wing length is 1 millimeter more or 1 millimeter less than this best value, then they live maybe 50 days less. And so there's clearly a best value, 66, or in the vicinity. And if you're bigger or smaller, you suffer. And that's an ingredient one can put into modeling of quantitative traits. And so related to this, it's essentially the same diagram, is a paper I wrote with Joel Peck, who's somewhere in the audience. And so again, there's a best trait value. And if you deviate, if you're bigger or smaller, you suffer. You have a decreased chance of surviving. And this occurs not just in birds. In fact, if you look at human birth weights, there's an increased mortality rate if you deviate from the mean weight of the population. So if you have a large baby or a light baby, again, you slightly decreased probability of surviving. And it occurs in many other things. So we looked at this, and we looked at this with a twist. We took into account environmental change. Environmental change, of course, it's in the news, is just something, a different sort of warbler, different sort of bird. I grabbed from The Independent a couple of days ago. This global warming appears to be causing these birds to have longer migrations, and they're suffering because of that. So that's one example of a changing environment. But in fact, the environment that Joel and I were thinking of when we wrote this paper is more like this, that you have two species and they're strongly interacting with each other and they're co-evolving. So you can imagine if the hair changed, if the hair mutated, the lynx is going to suffer a great deal if the hare can run a lot faster. And so if one changes, the other changes. And that's the sort of picture we have all the time, that populations of living organisms, they're all moving all the time. They cannot keep still because there's something affecting them that will catch them up, in some sense, if they do keep still. So all the time, things are moving. So the paper we wrote, it was called Sex and Adaptation in a Changing Environment. And this was followed up with papers of a couple of master's students of mine, one of them, Yabel C, she's in the audience. And what do we mean by environmental change? Environmental change means the best trait value changes with time. What does that mean? So here's, again, this survival probability. If you've got this trait value, 7, you've got the greatest chance of surviving. If you have more than 7 or less than 7, you have a decreased chance of surviving. So environmental change means this thing changes with time. The best trait value is now 8, or 9, or 10, or 11, something like that. And so the environmental change is the change of this optimum, this best value. We took this into account in a paper we published in the journal Genetics. And in fact, what you've got is a more complicated diagram of the diagram I put up before. You've got mutations coming into the population. And you've got, say, 10 genes that affect the trait, and you've got a situation where mutation, a gene starts off in its original state, and at some point the number increase, and at some point perhaps the number get to 100% of the population. And what that means is that in this region here, where basically nobody has the gene, you can imagine they're a certain size. There's a certain width of, say, the bird's wings. When you're up here, and everybody carries the genes, the width of the wings is larger. And somewhere in the middle, here, you've got a mixture. Some individuals in the population don't carry the mutation and they're small. Some individuals in the population do carry the mutation and they're large. And of course, there's some sort of competition goes on. And so the mutations, if we can quickly summarize it, the mutations affect the genes controlling the trait, like wing length, and then they change the trait. And so mutations, which often get a bad press, that they're all bad, they're in fact very important. They allow the population to cope with the continued environmental change. And they allow it to cope because they allow the trait to change, but not perfectly. And the typical survival probability decreases under environmental change, not surprising. So in other words, here's our probability of surviving, here's the best value, and when a population has a static environment, and so this best value stays fixed, the average trait value in the population adjusts and it will come to be the best value. When the environment changes, the best trait value is moving along, the average trait value decreases. And this is very much like the bird having a deviation from the best value. So you suffer. And this has direct implications for evolution in changing environments, obviously, evolution of sex, conservation. Now, I've spoken a little bit about this, and let me just touch on this topic. Here's a graph, and I'll explain it. Suppose you have a population, a sexual population, of males and females, therefore, in a static environment. If a mutation occurs, and a mutation, in some sense, stops the production of males, and the population is actually more efficient. It's actually twice as efficient. All the resources go into females, which then just copy themselves, and that's an asexual population. So there's an immediate benefit of switching from being sexual to being asexual. But this work that I did with Joel, it shows that when you have a changing environment, you may get that benefit. You get that benefit, but also you suffer a cost. An asexual population, in a certain sense, is much less flexible than a sexual population. It cannot keep up with the changing environment. So that has a benefit of not producing males. It has a subsequent cost of not being able to keep up the environment. Now, I could say more about this, but it starts to get technical. I mean, we've done fairly precise calculations for the rate of change of the movement of this best trait value. But then we'd have to talk about the units we measured it in. And if I started saying we're measuring this in phenotypic standard deviations per generation, it doesn't really mean that much. So I'm not going to say any more about that. I'm going to get on to one last topic, and that's some recent work I've done with Jonathan Bacon and Pierre Nouvio. Pierre is a very great PhD student. Jonathan and I are very pleased and proud to be working with him. We've been investigating ant behavior. Sounds completely different. What's the connection? Is there any connection? We looked at Pharaoh's ants. They're not this big, fortunately. They're 2 millimeters, in fact, and we take great efforts to contain them because they probably take over this building and eat it in some terrible way. So they're 2 millimeters long, but we have a lot of respect for these creatures. The man who won the 100 meters in the Olympics, Usain Bolt, he ran it in about 10 seconds, 9 seconds, something, and he waved at the end. But if you work out how fast he's going about 5 body lengths per second. These little creatures that we routinely run around the lab, and they go about 10 body lengths per second. So if they were scaled up to human size, they'd be waving at Usain Bolt, and he wouldn't be waving at them. So they're quite remarkable, and they're very interesting creatures. And so let me give you a very quick description of a recent experiment we've carried out. We've got ants in a nest, and we construct a bridge, and some of the ants can find the bridge, and the bridge will take the ants to a new area. At the far end of the bridge, we've made it slippery. So the ants that find the bridge and get there, they will slip off. Don't hurt themselves, they just slip off. We like our ants. And these ants, the ones that slip off, they're just unable to return to the nest, and so they can't get back to the nest until we let them at the end of the experiment. And this experiment is a very controlled way of investigating something such as extremely high levels of mortality of an ant's nest due to attack. Here's a giant anteater, and these can come in, and they can basically stop ants. They would take ants, and the ants that get eaten by these, they're not going to return to the nest. Of course, many other things going on, but we're doing a very simple controlled situation. So we've done this experiment where you've got this very controlled removal and non-return of the ants to the nest. And if you plot the number of ants remaining in the nest, it looks something like this. It goes down in steps of one because an ant finds the bridge, falls off, cannot get back. And the experiments last an hour, maybe 2 hours. And of course, we've seen something like this already. It looks a bit like a population, but we've got something occurring. We've only got deaths occurring. They're only decreasing. The numbers are only decreasing by one. And so if we wish to model and simulate what occurs, maybe it occurs to you now, we'd say, well, we have some sort of random time interval for an ant to find the bridge, and then it drops off, and then we wait another random time interval, and so on. And of course, you know now that where we embed the model is in the choice of how we choose these random time intervals. Of course, it's analogous to flipping a coin, but then it's the bias of the coin, and we're going to choose that according to the number of the ants. But if you're thinking this way, then you're starting to think like me, and then you're starting to think that ants coming out of a nest, very much like births and deaths, very much like mutations. And I think that's a thing that modeling teaches me, that many different things all start to look the same. So before you acquire this corrupt viewpoint, I will stop and summarize what I'm talking about. I've spoken about mathematical models in biology, and we've visited quite a few subjects. I've shown you a little of the world that connects biology and randomness, and I hope you've learned something new about the application of mathematics to biology and its usefulness. I'm not quite finished. This is inspiration. This is a cartoon I found 25 years ago. I haven't changed the words. It really says Professor Waxman and his time machine and so on. So this is inspiration for possibly why I'm here today, because of this cartoon. I won't say anything more than that, but honestly, I haven't changed the words. two papers I did not write. This is on bone growth, And this is on strategic communication. This is written by authors in the University of Arizona. When Americans say strategic communication, they mean something pretty serious. Okay. Why am I talking about these? And what do I know about bone growth? Well, I know I've grown my own bones and I've broken quite a few of them. But in fact, this paper uses some ideas of a paper that Joel Peck and I wrote on bias mutation. So it's rather a surprise to us that these ideas in a genetic context, they're of relevance in a completely different context that we know nothing about. This paper was written with John Welsh, and this was about those probabilities of survival and in more complicated situations where you've got multiple hills. So there's the word rugged, finding the right message in a rugged landscape. And I think that's, to me, always a surprise. You do something, you're sitting in your office or your lab, and you're thinking about something, and then somebody finds a different way of using or thinking about what you've done. Thanks. I have, of course, no man is an island, and I have lots of connections. I'm not very good at firing. And so teachers often can become colleagues, and colleagues can become collaborators. I certainly learn from students, so I wouldn't know where to put anybody, or they'd be in multiple categories. So I will stop there and simply say thank you for coming and listening. Thanks very much.